less personal, less judgmental, and equally impactful, it's easier to maintain a sense of safety and belonging in the group. Embrace the discomfort. One of the most difficult things about creating habits of vulnerability is that it requires a group to endure two discomforts, emotional pain and a sense of inefficiency. Doing an AAR or a brain trust combines the repetition of digging into something that already happened, shouldn't we be moving forward, with the burning awkwardness inherent in confronting unpleasant truths. But as with any workout, the key is to understand that the pain is not a problem, but the path to building a stronger group. Align language with action. Many highly cooperative groups use language to reinforce their interdependence. For example, Navy pilots returning to aircraft carriers do not land, but are recovered. IDEO doesn't have project managers, it has design community leaders. Groups at Pixar do not offer notes on early versions of films, they plus them by offering solutions to problems. These might seem like small semantic differences, but they matter because they continually highlight the cooperative, interconnected nature of the work and reinforce the group's shared identity. Build a wall between performance review and professional development. While it seems natural to hold these two conversations together, in fact, it's more effective to keep performance review and professional development separate. Performance evaluation tends to be a high-risk, inevitably judgmental interaction, often with salary-related consequences. Development, on the other hand, is about identifying strengths and providing support and opportunities for growth. Linking them into one conversation muddies the waters. Relatedly, many groups have moved away from ranking workers and shifted to more of a coaching model, where people receive frequent feedback designed to provide them with both a vivid performance snapshot and a path for improvement. Use flash mentoring. One of the best techniques I've seen for creating cooperation in a group is flash mentoring. It is exactly like traditional mentoring. You pick someone you want to learn from and shadow them, except that instead of months or years, it lasts a few hours. Those brief interactions help break down barriers inside a group, build relationships, and facilitate the awareness that fuels helping behavior. Make the leader occasionally disappear. Several leaders of successful groups have the habit of leaving the group alone at key moments. One of the best at this is Greg Popovich. Most NBA teams run timeouts according to a choreographed protocol. First, the coaches huddle as a group for a few seconds to settle on a message. Then they walk over to the bench to deliver that message to the players. However, during about one timeout a month, the Spurs coaches huddle for a timeout and then never walk over to the players. The players sit on the bench, waiting for Popovich to show up. Then, as they belatedly realize he isn't coming, they take charge, start talking among themselves, and figure out a plan. The New Zealand All Blacks rugby team have made a habit of this, as players lead several practice sessions each week with little input from the coaches. When I asked Dave Cooper to name the single trait that his best-performing SEAL teams shared, he said, "The best teams tended to be the ones I wasn't that involved with, especially when it came to training. They would disappear and not rely on me at all. They were better at figuring out what they needed to do themselves than I could ever be." Skill 3. Establish purpose. 13. 311 words. One day in 1975, James Burke, president of the healthcare company Johnson & Johnson, summoned 35 of the company's senior managers for an unconventional meeting. They weren't going to talk about strategy or marketing or planning or anything to do with business, really. The goal was to discuss a 32-year-old one-page document called The Credo. The Credo had been written in 1943 by Robert Wood Johnson, the company's former chairman and a member of its founding family. Here's how it begins. We believe our first responsibility is to doctors, nurses, and patients, to mothers and fathers, and all others who use our products and services. In meeting their needs, everything we do must be of high quality. We must constantly strive to reduce our costs in order to maintain reasonable prices. Customers' orders must be serviced promptly and accurately. It goes on like that for four paragraphs, describing the relationship to each group of stakeholders and prioritizing them as follows. 1. Customers. 2. Employees. 3. Community. And 4. Company stockholders. As value statements go, it's a solid one, clear, forthright, and ringing with Old Testament gravitas. The word must appears 21 times. The Credo was prominently displayed at all Johnson & Johnson businesses and was carved into a granite wall at the company's New Jersey headquarters. The problem, as Burke saw it, was that the Credo didn't seem to matter much to many employees, and what was more, he wasn't sure that it should matter. Times had changed. It wasn't that there was an open revolt against the Credo. It was more that Burke picked up a subtle vibe as he traveled around the company and watched people work and interact. As he said later, a lot of the young people that were coming into Johnson & Johnson really didn't pay much attention to it. Many of them felt that it was kind of a public relations gimmick. It wasn't a unifying document. Burke's idea was to hold a meeting to determine what role the Credo had in the company's future. When he proposed his idea, many Johnson & Johnson leaders rejected it outright. To question such a foundational document seemed a waste of time. Dick Sellers, chairman of the board, called the notion ridiculous. He told Burke that challenging the Credo would be like a Catholic deciding to challenge the Pope. Burke, a gravel-voiced Vermonter who'd commanded a landing craft during World War II, didn't back down. "I challenge the Pope every day when I wake up," he said. "I think at times he's crazy. I think at times my religion is nuts. Of course I challenge it. Everybody challenges their values, and that's what we ought to do with the Credo." He prevailed. The meeting was held in a large banquet room. After the managers took their seats, Burke outlined their task. "You guys are in a position of being able to challenge this document, which is the soul of the corporation," he said. "And if you can't live by its principles, we ought to tear it off the walls, because it's an act of pretension to leave it there. And if you want to change it, tell us how it ought to be changed." With that, the conversation began. "I think the Credo should be an absolute," said one manager. "You can't kid yourself," interrupted another. "The purpose of the business is to make a profit." Another manager spoke up. "Should we not therefore do what is best for the business, not only what is morally and ethically correct, but what is best for the business by following the Credo so that we do meet the needs of society and therefore are able to do things better and decent and human?" "Charlie, that's motherhood and apple pie, and we're all in agreement with that," said a sharp-voiced man with a comb-over. "The question is, which of these are legitimate demands of society, and how many of these can we fulfill and stay in business?" You get the idea. This wasn't a business meeting. It was closer to a college philosophy seminar. For the entire day, the 36 people in that room attempted to locate the company's place in the moral universe. That night, some stayed up late putting thoughts to paper. By the end of the process, they reached a consensus to recommit to the existing Credo. Over the next several years, Burke kept recreating this conversation, holding Credo challenges at all levels of the company. And the challenges seemed to work. He and others sensed that employees seemed to have a fresh awareness of the Credo. But of course, these kinds of things are mostly intangible, difficult to measure in the course of normal life. 7 years later, on September 30th, 1982, normal life came to an abrupt halt. Burke received a phone call that 6 people were dead in Chicago because they had ingested his company's product, extra-strength Tylenol capsules that had been laced with cyanide. In Chicago, panic ensued. Police roamed the streets using bullhorns to warn people. Boy Scout troops went door to door to alert elderly people who might have missed the warnings. The following day, a 7th victim was found, and worries continued to spread. Officials in San Francisco warned residents not to flush their Tylenol down the toilet, lest they risk contaminating the sewage system with poison. One news service calculated that the Tylenol poisonings generated the widest U.S. news coverage since the assassination of President Kennedy. In a few hours, Johnson & Johnson went from being a provider of medicine to being a provider of poison. The atmosphere at headquarters was a mix of shock and disbelief. The larger problem, from Johnson & Johnson's perspective, was that the company was not equipped to deal with this crisis. It didn't have a public affairs division or a system for recalling pills, and its media relations system consisted of a spiral notebook. "It looked like the plague," said David Collins, chairman of McNeil Products, the Johnson subsidiary that made Tylenol. "We had no idea where it would end, and the only information we had was that we didn't know what was going on." An office at company headquarters was converted into a makeshift war room. Someone located drawing paper and an easel. As information came in, victims, locations, lot numbers of the pills, location of purchase, it was scrawled on sheets of paper, which were then taped to the walls. Before long, the walls were draped with urgent questions to which there were no answers. The only certainty was that Tylenol was finished as a business. "I don't think they can ever sell another product under that name," Jerry Delafamina, a legendary advertising guru, told the New York Times. Burke formed a 7-member committee who started working their way through the cascade of tough decisions. How should they work with law enforcement? What should they tell the public? Most crucially, what should they do with other Tylenol products that were on shelves around the nation? 4 days after the poisonings, Burke and other members of the committee flew to Washington, D.C. to discuss strategy with the FBI and the Food and Drug Administration, FDA. The FBI and the FDA strongly encouraged Burke to limit the recall to Chicago, since no poison had yet been located outside Chicago. A national recall, they said, would needlessly frighten the public, embolden the poisoner, and encourage copycats. And as the FBI didn't need to point out, a larger recall would cost Johnson & Johnson millions of dollars. Burke and his group thought about it for a while. Then they ignored the advice of the FBI and the FDA and ordered an immediate national recall of every Tylenol product on the market, 31 million pills in all, at a cost of $100 million. When Burke was asked for his reasoning behind the decision, the answer came quickly. "We believe our first responsibility is to doctors, nurses, and patients, to mothers and fathers, and all others who use our products and services." Over the next days and weeks, Johnson & Johnson essentially transformed itself from a pharmaceutical company into a public safety organization. It designed and manufactured innovative tamper-proof packaging, developed exchange, disposal, and refund programs, and built relationships with government, law enforcement, and media. 4 weeks after the attacks, it mobilized more than 2,000 salespeople to visit doctors and pharmacists to listen to their concerns and inform them of the upcoming changes. Burke terrified the company's lawyers by making the rounds on the national media, openly expressing his grief and regret, and sharing the steps the company was making to ensure the public's safety. 6 weeks after the attacks, it introduced new, safer packaging. And then something unexpected happened. Tylenol's market share, after dropping to zero after the attacks, began a slow climb back to previous levels and continued to grow. One pundit termed it the greatest comeback since Lazarus. In ensuing years, Tylenol's response has become the gold standard for handling corporate crisis. We had to make hundreds of decisions on the fly. Hundreds of people made thousands of decisions, Burke said afterward. If you look back, we didn't make any bad decisions, really. We really didn't. Those thousands of decisions all had a splendid consistency about them, and that was that the public was going to be served first, because that's who was at stake. So the reason people talk about Tylenol when the Credo discussions come up is that the Credo ran that. Because the hearts and minds of the people who were J&J and who were making the decisions in a whole series of disparate companies, they all knew what to do. On the surface, the story of the Tylenol crisis is about a large group responding to disaster with extraordinary cohesion and focus. But beneath that story lies a curious fact. The key to Johnson & Johnson's extraordinary behavior can be located in a mundane, one-page document. The 311 words of the Credo oriented the thinking and behavior of thousands of people as they navigated a complex landscape of choices. The deeper question is, how can a handful of simple, forthright sentences make such a difference in a group's behavior? In the first two sections of this book, we focused on safety and vulnerability. We've seen how small signals, "You are safe, we share risk here," connect people and enable them to work together as a single entity. But now it's time to ask, what's this all for? What are we working toward? When I visited the successful groups, I noticed that whenever they communicated anything about their purpose or their values, they were as subtle as a punch in the nose. It started with the surroundings. One expects most groups to fill their surroundings with a few reminders of their mission. These groups, however, did more than that. A lot more. When you walk into SEAL headquarters at Dam Neck, Virginia, you pass a twisted girder from the World Trade Center bombing, a flag from Mogadishu, and so many memorials to fallen SEALs that it resembles a military museum. Similarly, walking into Pixar's headquarters feels like walking into one of its movies. From the full-size Woody and Buzz made of Legos to the 20-foot-tall Luxo lamp outside the entrance, everything gleams with Pixarian magic. As for the Upright Citizens Brigade comedy troupe, its basement theater is less a theater than a makeshift hall of fame, its walls plastered with photos of the Herald teams that have made it big. You can spot a not-yet-famous celebrity in almost every one. KIPP schools, the highly successful inner-city charter schools, take a similar approach, naming and decorating each classroom to spotlight where the teacher attended college in order to inspire students to do the same, even adorning the bathroom mirrors with an important question. Where will you go to college? What's more, the same focus exists within their language. Walking around these places, you tend to hear the same catchphrases and mottos delivered in the same rhythms. This is surprising, since you could easily presume that Pixarians would not need to be reminded that technology inspires art, and art inspires technology. That the SEALs would not need to be reminded that it's important to shoot, move, and communicate. And that KIPP students would not need to be reminded to work hard and be nice, given that they say these words many times each day. And yet that is what they do. These groups, who by all rights should know what they stand for, devote a surprising amount of time telling their own story, reminding each other precisely what they stand for, then repeating it ad infinitum. Why? The first step toward an answer might begin with a small, ordinary-looking songbird called the starling. Like other birds, starlings sometimes congregate in large flocks. When those flocks are threatened by a predator like a falcon, however, they transform into something more. It's called a murmuration, and it's one of the most beautiful and uncanny sights in nature. A living cloud that swirls and changes shape at the speed of thought, forming giant hourglasses, spirals, and tendrils that flow across the sky like a special effect from a Harry Potter movie. A falcon swoops toward a single starling, and at the same instant, on the other side of the flock, thousands of birds away, the other birds instantly sense it and react as one to flow away from the danger. The question, of course, is how so many birds behave like a single entity. Early naturalists theorized that starlings possessed some quasi-mystical ESP to perceive and plan group movements. One British scientist termed it telepathy. Another called it biological radio. The real reason, demonstrated in a 2007 study by a team of theoretical physicists from the University of Rome, is that the starling's cohesion is built on relentless attention to a small set of signals. Basically, each starling tracks the six or seven birds closest to it, sending and receiving cues of direction, speed, acceleration, and distance. That shared habit of intensive, up-close watching, amplified through the flock, allows the group to behave as one. In other words, the reason starling flocks can behave so intelligently has nothing to do with telepathy or magic, and everything to do with a simpler ability, to pay focused attention to a small handful of key markers. This idea helps give us a window into how successful cultures create and sustain purpose. Successful groups are attuned to the same truth as the starlings. Purpose isn't about tapping into some mystical internal drive, but rather about creating simple beacons that focus attention and engagement on the shared goal. Successful cultures do this by relentlessly seeking ways to tell and retell their story. To do this, they build what we'll call high-purpose environments. High-purpose environments are filled with small, vivid signals designed to create a link between the present moment and a future ideal. They provide the two simple locators that every navigation process requires. Here is where we are, and here is where we want to go. The surprising thing, from a scientific point of view, is how responsive we are to this pattern of signaling. A few years ago, a professor of psychology named Gabriella Uttingen set out to perform what might rank as the most basic psychological experiment of all time. In fact, you can do it right now. It goes like this. Step 1. Think about a realistic goal that you'd like to achieve. It could be anything. Become skilled at a sport, rededicate yourself to a relationship, lose a few pounds, get a new job. Spend a few seconds reflecting on that goal and imagining that it's come true. Picture a future where you've achieved it. Got it? Step 2, take a few seconds and picture the obstacles between you and that goal as vividly as possible. Don't gloss over the negatives, but try to see them as they truly are. For example, if you were trying to lose weight, you might picture those moments of weakness when you smell warm cookies and you decide to eat one or three. That's it. It's called mental contrasting, and it seems less like science than the kind of advice you might come across on a late-night infomercial. Envision a reachable goal and envision the obstacles. The thing is, as Uttingen discovered, this method works, triggering significant changes in behavior and motivation. In one study, adolescents preparing for the PSAT who used this method chose to complete 60% more practice questions than the control group. In another, dieters consumed significantly fewer calories, were more physically active, and lost more weight. Mental contrasting has also been shown to improve the ability to interact positively with strangers, negotiate deals, speak in public, manage time, improve communication, and perform a range of other skills. As Uttingen wrote, the conjoint elaboration of the future and the present reality makes both simultaneously accessible and links them together in the sense that the reality stands in the way of realizing the desired future. Uttingen's work doesn't line up with how we normally think about motivation and goals. We normally think about them as being intrinsic to a person. People are either motivated or they're not. Accordingly, we describe motivation with terms like desire or heart. But in these experiments, motivation is not a possession, but rather the result of a two-part process of channeling your attention. Here's where you're at, and here's where you want to go. That shared future could be a goal or a behavior. We put customer safety first. We shoot, move, and communicate. It doesn't matter. What matters is establishing this link and consistently creating engagement around it. What matters is telling the story. We tend to use the word story casually, as if stories and narratives were ephemeral decorations for some unchanging, underlying reality. The deeper neurological truth is that stories do not cloak reality, but create it, triggering cascades of perception and motivation. The proof is in brain scans. When we hear a fact, a few isolated areas of our brain light up, translating words and meanings. When we hear a story, however, our brain lights up like Las Vegas, tracing the chains of cause, effect, and meaning. Stories are not just stories. They are the best invention ever created for delivering mental models that drive behavior. Think for a moment about the jungle of decisions Johnson & Johnson leaders faced in the days after the Tylenol poisonings. It is not easy to spend $100 million against the advice of federal officials, or to explain that decision to stockholders and a board of trustees. It is not easy to repurpose thousands of people into new and unfamiliar roles, or to explain why they should embrace that change. One would presume that these decisions and actions would have felt painful or agonizing. And yet Burke doesn't describe them as painful or agonizing. He describes them as straightforward. "Well, I got a lot of credit for that," he told a reporter. "But the fact is, my job was made not only simple, but there wasn't anything else I could have done. Every person who worked for Johnson & Johnson in the world was watching the poisonings. If we had done anything other than what we did, think about how those employees would have felt. I mean, the very soul of the corporation was watching us." In other words, Burke and his team felt a bit like starlings in a flock feel. They moved as one because they were attuned to the same clear signal of the credo resonating through the group. We believe our first responsibility is to doctors, nurses, and patients, to mothers and fathers, and all others who use our products and services. The difficult choices they made weren't really all that difficult. They were closer to a reflex. The main challenge to understanding how stories guide group behavior is that stories are hard to isolate. Stories are like air, everywhere and nowhere at the same time. How do you measure the effect of a narrative? Fortunately for us, back in 1965, a Harvard psychologist named Robert Rosenthal found a way. He approached a California public elementary school and offered to test the school's students with a newly developed intelligence identification tool called the Harvard Test of Inflected Acquisition, which could accurately predict which children would excel academically in the coming year. The school naturally agreed, and the test was administered to the entire student body. A few weeks later, teachers were provided with the names of the children, about 20% of the student body, who had tested as high potentials. These particular children, the teachers were informed, were special. Though they might not have performed well in the past, the test indicated that they possessed unusual potential for intellectual growth. The students were not informed of the test results. The following year, Rosenthal returned to measure how the high potential students had performed. Exactly as the test had predicted, the first and second grade high potentials had succeeded to a remarkable degree. The first graders gained 27 IQ points versus 12 points for the rest of the class, and the second graders gained 17 points versus 7 points. In addition, The high potentials thrived in ways that went beyond measurement. They were described by their teachers as being more curious, happier, better adjusted, and more likely to experience success as adults. What's more, the teachers reported that they had enjoyed teaching that year more than any year in the past. Here's the twist. The Harvard test of inflected acquisition was complete baloney. In fact, the high potentials had been selected at random. The real subject of the test was not the students, but the narratives that drive the relationship between the teachers and the students. What happened, Rosenthal discovered, was replacing one story, these are average kids, with a new one, these are special kids, destined to succeed, served as a locator beacon that reoriented the teachers, creating a cascade of behaviors that guided the student toward that future. It didn't matter that the story was false, or that the children were, in fact, randomly selected. The simple, glowing idea, this child has unusual potential for intellectual growth, aligned motivations, awareness, and behaviors. Rosenthal classified the changes into four categories. 1. Warmth. The teachers were kinder, more attentive, and more connective. 2. Input. The teachers provided more material for learning. 3. Response opportunity. The teachers called on the students more often and listened more carefully. 4. Feedback. The teachers provided more, especially when the student made a mistake. The interesting thing about these changes is how small they are, consisting of thousands of tiny behaviors over the school year. Every time the teacher interacted with the student, a connection lit up in the teacher's brain between the present and the future. Each time the student did something ambiguous, the teacher gave the student the benefit of the doubt. Each time the student made a mistake, the teacher presumed that the student needed better feedback. By themselves, each of these behaviors meant little. Together, they created a virtuous spiral that helped students thrive in ways that exceeded their so-called limits. This virtuous spiral can be sparked by other methods as well. A good example was used in an experiment by Adam Grant, an author and organizational psychologist at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, whose work we encountered in Chapter 6. A few years back, Grant was asked by the University of Michigan to look into the low performance of its call center workers who phoned university alumni and asked them to donate money. The work was repetitive and tedious, and the rejection rate stood at a solid 93%. The university had tried several incentives to improve performance, such as prizes and contests, to no avail. Grant knew that some of the money raised at the call center went towards scholarships. He wondered if the workers would be more motivated if they knew more about the real-world uses of that money. So he tracked down one of the scholarship recipients, a student named Will, and asked him to write a letter about what his scholarship meant to him. Here is an excerpt. When it came down to making the decision, I discovered that the out-of-state tuition was quite expensive. But this university is in my blood. My grandparents met here. My dad and his four brothers all went here. I even owe my younger brother to this school. He was conceived the night we won the NCAA basketball tournament. All my life, I have dreamed of coming here. I was ecstatic to receive the scholarship, and I came to school ready to take full advantage of the opportunities it afforded me. The scholarship has improved my life in many ways. After Grant shared Will's letter with the call center workers, he saw an immediate boost in calls and donations. So he took the next step. Rather than merely read call center workers a letter, Grant brought in scholarship recipients for in-person visits. The visits lasted 5 minutes. They weren't complex. Each student shared their story as Will had done. Here is where I came from. Here is what the money raised by your work means to me. Over the next month, time spent calling increased 142%, and weekly revenues increased 172%. The incentives hadn't changed. The task hadn't changed. All that had changed was the fact that the workers had received a clear beacon of purpose, and it made all the difference. What happened in Rosenthal's and Grant's experiments is no different from what happened when Johnson & Johnson gathered to challenge the credo. They created a high-purpose environment, flooded the zone with signals that linked the present effort to a meaningful future, and used a single story to orient motivation the way that a magnetic field orients a compass needle to true north. This is why we work. Here is where you should put your energy. In the next chapter, we'll focus on real-world ways in which high-purpose environments are established and nurtured. And a good way to begin is to examine two cases where those environments were built against the odds. The first involves an innovative attempt to control some of the most dangerous soccer hooligans on the planet. The second involves teams of doctors learning to perform a revolutionary surgical innovation. 14. The Hooligans and the Surgeons. Taming the Hooligans. Portugal was about to get wrecked. It was the eve of the 2004 European Championships, an every 4 years soccer tournament that ranks second only to the World Cup in size and spectacle. Hundreds of thousands of fans were streaming towards sparkling venues across this sunny nation. For Portugal, this was a big moment, its coming out party on the world sporting stage. There was just one problem, and it was the same problem that has shadowed European soccer for decades. English soccer hooligans. The Portuguese organizers knew what they were up against because the previous championships, held 4 years earlier in Belgium, had provided a vivid lesson. The Belgian police had prepared well for the hooligans, spending millions training their force and equipping themselves with the best anti-riot equipment, surveillance cameras, and information systems available. They had worked closely with the British government to identify and bar known troublemakers from entering the country. In short, they had been as ready as it was possible to be. And none of it had helped. Thousands of English hooligans, showing the sort of unified resolve their team has historically lacked, roamed wild, smashing shop windows, beating up bystanders, and battling riot police wielding batons, fire hoses, and tear gas. By tournament's end, more than 1,000 English supporters were arrested. Tournament organizers considered banishing the English team from the tournament, and pundits were wondering whether international tournaments might be a thing of the past. According to most social scientists, this reality was both logical and historically unavoidable, as English hooligans embodied the working-class aggression known as the English disease. Decades of experience showed that the disease could not be cured, only its symptoms controlled. As the 2004 tournament approached, riots seemed inevitable. As one English writer put it, sunny Portugal was about to become the target of the biggest English invasion since D-Day. To prepare, the Portuguese government purchased $21 million of riot control tools, water cannons, truncheons, pepper spray, and police dogs. It also looked at new approaches, including the work of an obscure Liverpool University social psychologist named Clifford Stott. Stott is a plain-spoken, crew-cut man who specializes in crowd violence. He studied the Los Angeles riots of 1992 and the UK poll tax riots of 1990, and as the 2004 championships approached, he was working on a new theory that had less to do with the forces of social history than with social cues. His idea was that it was possible to stop crowd violence by changing the signals the police were transmitting. In his view, riot gear and armored cars were cues that activated hooligan behavior in fans who might otherwise behave normally. 95% of the people arrested for soccer violence, his research showed, had no prior history of disorderly conduct. Stott believed that the key to policing riots was to essentially stop policing riots. Stott's early trials of his model were sufficiently compelling, and the Portuguese authorities were sufficiently desperate, that Stott found himself, to his everlasting surprise, in charge of a high-stakes experiment. Could the most dangerous soccer hooligans in the world be stopped by a handful of social cues? First, Stott set about training the Portuguese police. Rule number one was to keep all riot gear out of sight. No phalanxes of helmeted cops, no armored vehicles, no riot shields and batons. Instead, Stott trained a crew of liaison officers who wore light blue vests instead of the customary yellow. These officers were selected not for their riot control skills, but for their social skills, friendliness, and ability to banter. Stott encouraged them to study up on the teams and fans and get good at making small talk about the coaches, on-field strategies, and team gossip. "We sought out people who had the gift of the gab," he says, "who could throw their arm around someone and chat with them about anything." The bigger challenge for Stott was rewiring police instincts. The English hooligans had a habit of kicking soccer balls in public places, booting the ball high into the air and down onto the heads and cafe tables of bystanders, thus igniting the kind of small-scale confrontations of which riots are born. Conventional police procedure is to immediately and forcibly intervene and confiscate the ball before any open fighting breaks out. But on Stott's advice, Portuguese officers were instructed to do something more difficult, to wait until the hooligans kicked the ball within reach of the police. Then, and only then, could the police take the ball and keep it. "You have to play by the shared rules," Stott says. "The police can't just go take the ball, because that's precisely the kind of disproportionate use of force that creates the problem. If you wait until the ball comes to you and simply hang on to it, the crowd sees it as legitimate." To some Portuguese police, Stott's ideas sounded illogical, if not insane. Several protested, saying that facing gangs of violent hooligans without protective armor was reckless. By the time the tournament arrived, the English press had derisively termed the program "Hug a Thug." The sporting and scientific worlds waited doubtfully to see if Stott's method would work. It worked. More than 1 million fans visited the country over the 3-week-long tournament, and in areas that used Stott's approach, only one English fan was arrested. Observers recorded 2,000 crowd police interactions, of which only 0.4% qualified as disorderly. The only incidents of violence occurred in an area that was policed according to the old-fashioned helmet and shield system. In the ensuing years, Stott's approach has become the model for controlling sport-related violence in Europe and around the globe. One of the reasons it works is that it creates a high-purpose environment by delivering an unbroken array of consistent little signals. Every time an officer banters with a fan, every time a fan notices the lack of protective armor, a signal is sent. We are here to get along. Every time the police allow fans to keep kicking the ball, they reinforce that signal. By themselves, none of the signals matter. Together, they build a new story. For Stott, the most revealing moment in Portugal came halfway through the tournament, when a yellow-vested Portuguese policeman had an encounter with an overly exuberant English fan. The policeman tried to calm the fan resisted, and then the policeman reflexively used force, grabbing the fan roughly. A ripple of energy moved through the crowd. People shouted and pushed. It was exactly the kind of situation Stott feared most, a single overuse of force that could cause a disastrous spiral. But that didn't happen. Instead, the fans shouted out to one of the blue-vested liaison officers. The fans called over to the liaison and said, "Hey, can you come and sort this policeman out for us?" Stott says. The roles had reversed, and the fans were policing the police. They had socially bonded with the liaisons. They saw them as their advocate. the fastest learners. One of the best measures of any group's culture is its learning velocity, how quickly it improves its performance of a new skill. In 1998, a team of Harvard researchers led by Amy Edmondson, whom we met in Chapter 1, tracked the learning velocity of 16 surgical teams learning to perform a new heart surgery technique. The technique was called MIX, Minimally Invasive Cardiac Surgery, and it involved performing coronary artery bypass grafts and valve repairs through a small chest incision rather than by sawing the breastbone in half. Each of the 16 teams took the identical 3-day training program, then returned to their hospitals and started performing the procedure. The question was, which team would learn the fastest and most effectively? At the outset, the Chelsea Hospital team looked like it would win. The names of the hospitals and doctors were altered in the study. Chelsea was an elite teaching hospital in a metropolitan area. Its cardiac surgery team was led by Dr. C, a nationally recognized expert who had been involved in designing the MIX technology and who had already performed more than 60 procedures using the method. In addition, Chelsea had a strong organizational commitment to the new procedure, which it demonstrated by sending several department heads to the training course. At the other end of the scale was the team from Mountain Medical Center, which was smaller, not a teaching institution, and located in a rural area. Its team was led by Dr. M, a young surgeon who had never done the MIX procedure and who had a similarly inexperienced team around him. If you had to predict which team would perform better, Chelsea would be the logical choice. It had more expertise, more experience, and more organizational support than Mountain Medical. But as it turned out, Chelsea's team did not win. To the contrary, it was slower to learn, and its skill, measured by the time it took to successfully complete the MIX surgery, plateaued after 10 procedures. What's more, the team members weren't happy. In interviews afterward, they reported feeling dissatisfied. After 6 months, Chelsea ranked 10th out of 16 teams. The Mountain Medical team, on the other hand, learned fast and well. By the 5th surgery, its members were already faster than Chelsea's top mark. By the 20th procedure, Mountain Medical was completing successful surgeries a full hour faster than Chelsea, and, more important, was reporting high rates of efficiency and satisfaction. After 6 months, Mountain Medical ranked 2nd out of the 16 teams. This feast or famine pattern wasn't unique to these two hospitals. When Edmondson plotted the results, she found that hospitals fell into two groups, teams that had high success and teams that had low success. It wasn't a bell curve, it was more like a split screen. Teams were either like Mountain Medical or like Chelsea. They either clicked or they didn't. Why? The answer, Edmondson discovered, lay in the patterns of real-time signals through which the team members were connected, or not, with the purpose of the work. These signals consisted of 5 basic types. 1. Framing. Successful teams conceptualized MIX as a learning experience that would benefit patients and the hospital. Unsuccessful teams conceptualized MIX as an add-on to existing practices. 2. Roles. Successful teams were explicitly told by the team leader why their individual and collective skills were important for the team's success, and why it was important for them to perform as a team. Unsuccessful teams were not. 3. Rehearsal. Successful teams did elaborate dry runs of the procedure, preparing in detail, explaining the new protocols, and talking about communication. Unsuccessful teams took minimal steps to prepare. 4. Explicit encouragement to speak up. Successful teams were told by team leaders to speak up if they saw a problem. They were actively coached through the feedback process. The leaders of unsuccessful teams did little coaching, and as a result, team members were hesitant to speak up. 5. active reflection. Between surgeries, successful teams went over performance, discussed future cases, and suggested improvements. For example, the team leader at Mountain Medical wore a head-mounted camera during surgery to help facilitate discussion and feedback. Unsuccessful teams tended not to do this. Note what factors are not on this list: experience, surgeon status, and organizational support. These qualities mattered far less than the simple, steady pulse of real-time signals that channeled attention toward the larger goal. Sometimes those signals involved the hospital. Mix is an important learning opportunity. Sometimes the patient. Patients will benefit. Sometimes the team member. You have a role and a future with this team. Sometimes they placed value on rehearsal or reflection. But they all performed the same vital function: to flood the environment with narrative links between what they were doing now and what it meant. The other feature of this list is that many of these signals could easily be viewed as obvious and redundant. For instance, do highly experienced professionals like nurses and anesthesiologists really need to be explicitly told that their role in a cardiac surgery is important? Do they really need to be informed that if they see the surgeon make a mistake, they might want to speak up? The answer, as Edmondson discovered, is a thundering yes. The value of those signals is not in their information, but in the fact that they orient the team to the task and to one another. What seems like repetition is in fact navigation. Those signals added up in a way that you can hear in team members' voices. Listen to these quotes from the successful teams. Surgeon: the ability of the surgeon to allow himself to become a partner, not a dictator, is critical. For example, you really do have to change what you're doing during an operation based on a suggestion from someone else on the team. Nurse: we all have to share the knowledge. For example, in the last case, we needed to insert a guide wire, and I grabbed the wrong wire, and I didn't recognize it at first. And my circulating nurse said, "Sue, you grabbed the wrong wire." This shows how much the different roles don't matter. We all have to know about everything. You have to work as a team. Nurse: every time we are going to do a mixed procedure, I feel like I've been enlightened. I can see these patients doing so well. It is such a rewarding experience. I am so grateful I was picked. Now listen to these quotes from the unsuccessful teams. Surgeon: once I get a team set up, I never look up from the operating field. It's they who have to make sure everything is flowing. Anesthesiologist: I wouldn't speak up if I weren't confident that a mistake would lead to an adverse outcome. I'm not comfortable hypothesizing. Nurse: if I see a mix case on the list for tomorrow, I think, "Oh, do we really have to do it? Just get me a fresh blade so I can slash my wrists right now." These voices sound like they are coming from different universes. Ironically, both were doing the exact same procedure with the exact same training. The only difference was that one group received clear beacons of meaning throughout the process, and the other didn't. The difference wasn't in who they were, but in the set of small, attentive, consistent links between where they are now and where they are headed. This is the way high-purpose environments work. They are about sending not so much one big signal as a handful of steady, ultra-clear signals that are aligned with a shared goal. They are less about being inspiring than about being consistent. They are found not within big speeches so much as within everyday moments when people can sense the message. This is why we work. This is what we are aiming for. Now that we've established the basic mechanism of high-purpose environments, let's explore the next question. How do you create one? The answer, it turns out, depends on the type of skills you want your group to perform. High-proficiency environments help a group deliver a well-defined, reliable performance, while high-creativity environments help a group create something new. This distinction is important because it highlights the two basic challenges facing any group: consistency and innovation. And as we're about to see, building purpose in these two areas requires different approaches. 15. How to lead for proficiency. When you think of the planet's most challenging environments, you tend to envision places like Death Valley or Antarctica, unforgiving landscapes that relentlessly expose weakness. You don't tend to think of the New York restaurant scene, that is, until you consider the survival rates. Each year, around 1,000 new restaurants open in New York City. All are launched with optimism, confidence, and high hopes for success. 5 years later, 800 of them have vanished without a trace, for various reasons that are, in essence, the same reason. A successful restaurant, like a successful Antarctic expedition, depends on ceaseless proficiency. Good food is not enough. Good location is not enough. Good service, training, branding, leadership, adaptability, and luck are not enough. Survival depends on putting all of it together night after night. If you fail, you disappear. Within this unforgiving ecosystem, Danny Meyer has built a record that is not as unlikely as it is inconceivable. Over the past 30 years, he has opened 25 restaurants. Except for one, they are all successful, and not just a little bit. Union Square Cafe, Meyer's first restaurant, has won the top spot in Zagat's best restaurant rankings an unprecedented 9 times. His other restaurants routinely occupy as much as a quarter of the top 20, and his restaurants and chefs have won 26 James Beard Awards. Perhaps more impressively, each of Meyer's restaurants is unique, varying from a tavern to a barbecue joint to an Italian cafe to a fast casual burger chain called Shake Shack that is now worth $1.5 billion. The reason Meyer's restaurants are successful is the warm, connective feeling they create, a feeling that can be summed up in one word: home. When you walk into a Meyer restaurant, you feel that you are being cared for. This feeling radiates from the surroundings and the food, but most of all, from the people, who approach each interaction with familial thoughtfulness. When I asked Meyer's guests and employees for examples of moments where this feeling was created, they offered the following two stories. A young woman, recently moved to New York from the Midwest, took her parents out to dinner at 11 Madison Park to celebrate her new start in the big city and to allay her parents' fears about the difficulties of living in New York. Toward the end of dinner, as they looked over the dessert menu, the father pointed to a $42 glass of dessert wine called Chateau d'Yquem and commented on how insanely expensive New York was. The waiter overheard the father's comment and, moments later, reappeared carrying a bottle of Chateau d'Yquem and 3 glasses. The waiter said, "We are so grateful you came tonight. I heard you talking about the Chateau d'Yquem. This is one of the rarest and best dessert wines in the entire world, and we would love to offer you each a taste with our compliments." A small explosion of surprise and delight ensued. Then there was the time a dining companion of Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry found a beetle in his salad at Gramercy Tavern. The next day, Kerry and his friends were eating at another of Meyer's restaurants. After they were seated, a salad arrived, garnished with a small piece of paper on which the word Ringo was written. The waiter said, "Danny wanted to make sure you knew that Gramercy Tavern wasn't the only one of his restaurants that's willing to garnish your salad with a beetle." If you mention that it's your anniversary or your birthday, the restaurant will remember. If you prefer a table by the window, it will remember. If you prefer the crusty ends of bread, it will remember. Much of this remembering takes place within the reservation system, where guest preferences are religiously noted by waitstaff and managers. I saw one guest note that read, likes extra butter with bread, needs a lot of love. These tasks are not simple, because they depend on an unbroken chain of awareness and action. The waiter who brought the chateau